In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Welcome to hour number two of the program for Wednesday, December 15th, 2010 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We've talked a lot about cybersecurity on this program in the last several months and years that the program's been on the air. But there are some changes to the way that cybersecurity is being talked about and thought about and dealt with in the federal government. And one of those changes is the subject of a book that I'm pleased to talk about with the author today. His name is Richard Steenen. The book is called Surviving Cyber War. It is brand new. And Mr. Steenen, you are new in Washington today, just arriving earlier this afternoon. It's great to see you.
Thank you very much, Francis.
Thank you for coming in to talk about this today. As I mentioned, the title is Surviving Cyber War. And that's kind of one of the changes that I alluded to, is the fact that people are just starting to think about some of the cybersecurity challenges that we're dealing with as warfare, as an us versus them mentality. Talk about that a little bit, please.
Well, it's interesting that you've honed in on the change aspect, because that is, it almost appears to be just a steady march from 10 years ago with typical viruses and worms to cybercrime, which we experienced in the first half of this decade and, of course, still are. And finally now, you know, what I call state-sponsored or state-engaged cyber attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's when that starts to coincide with military activities, then you can start using terms like cyber war to describe it.
Mm-hmm. The military is understanding this with the appointment of General Alexander taking charge of cyber command. And the fact that there even is a cyber command is indicative of that. Are we starting to see, or are you starting to see indications on the civilian side in government and then also in the private sector amongst, especially amongst the contractors that do business with the government, that same, I hesitate to use the term warrior mentality on the civilian side, but also that same kind of mentality at least?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a recognition that there's going to be a lot of revamping of IT systems mm-hmm. to counter just the barrage of attacks that are going on. So even if you scan the job posting boards, as I do on a regular basis, because there's a lot of data in there, 10 years ago you searched for the word cyber, you would get nothing. Mm-hmm. Now you search for the word cyber just in a job title, and you get hundreds of postings, mm-hmm. All requiring, secret or top secret clearances, and at all of the classic, Raytheons and Lockheeds of the world.
Mm-hmm. In addition to your book, Surviving Cyber War, your blog is threatchaos.com, and you're writing about that issue on your blog, and that is fighting this cyber war and surviving it ostensibly require a different kind of person to do this. The federal government is really challenged as far as finding people to do it. They're fighting with their contractors for the same small workforce. What are the trends that we should be paying attention to about the cyber workforce, and who should we kind of be targeting to try to recruit to join this workforce?
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that the government's competing with the contractors, because that's exactly what's going on. I've talked to some of the big consulting firms that traditionally have maintained about 1,000 IT security auditors, assessors.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying that they're getting hired away directly into the government or into the more defense-related contractors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to find. IT security people are different from the rest of the people in your IT staff.
Mm-hmm.
They're paranoid. They're very driven by policy and enforcing rules. And then those that would be engaged in actually countering attacks are yet another realm or a way of thinking inside the engineer's mind, because
mm-hmm.
they really have to view it as a battle. And they do. They take it very, very personally. And one of the characters that I cover in the book, of course, is Sean Carpenter, who is one of these IT security administrators at Sandia Labs. And when he saw this exfiltration of data that he found on servers in China, I mean, it just riled him up to the point where he had to start backtracking and figuring out where the data had come from, and then working through military counterintelligence, informing people that, hey, you've got a hole. There's something going on here.
Yeah, tell that story, because that's one, I think, of the critical stories that you talk about in the book, and as we go back and examine what were some kind of pivotal moments in cybersecurity and the government's understanding of the potential danger that's out there.
Yeah, I think the story of Sean Carpenter and Titan Rain is really the the beginning of the whole cyber espionage story, in particular with an adversary like China, or at least hackers in China. And Sean Carpenter had been working for Sandia, which, of course, is operated by Lockheed Martin. And in the summer of 2003, he had to go down to one of Lockheed's facilities in Florida, where he saw this hacking activity going on. And they figured out the tools that the hackers were using, and he could get into these servers in Taiwan that the hacker had come from. And he found network scans for all of Fort Dix. So somebody had infected a machine inside Fort Dix and then scanned for vulnerabilities in the machine, which is the next step to going deeper in an incursion. Mm-hmm. So they cleaned up and they got all that resolved. And then they went back. He went back to Sandia, and he notices in his logs that the same IP address involved in those attacks is attacking Sandia. And that's when he, you know, uses his knowledge of the tools they're using to basically backhack and break into their systems, monitor where they came from, and ultimately trace it to inside mainland China. And that's where he found all these documents. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Sean isn't, you know, doesn't fall into the classification of a whistleblower. He went to his management at Lockheed. They told him, you know what, stick to your knitting. You know, we're not worried about national security. They really said that. We're just worried about Sandia, which is a research lab. Mm-hmm. Told him to stick to his knitting. So he went home and from home continued his research activities, and then started working with military counterintelligence to you know, warn the people that are being attacked. Ultimately, the FBI took him on as a confidential informant, and ultimately the FBI went back to Lockheed and said, hey, we'd like to formalize a relationship with one of your employees. When Lockheed found out, they fired him. So Sean had a really good wrongful discharge case and prosecuted that in Albuquerque and won. And that's about, you know, a couple years, a year after that is when I finally got to meet with him, start interviewing him, and it's a little frustrating because his final, you know, agreement on appeal, Lockheed appealed, he's not allowed to talk about the case at all. So he's kind of, he's gagged for good reasons. And but luckily the lawsuit itself was a court case, and it went over a week, and there's tons and tons of documents, so it's all well documented.
That case, as you said, kind of brought awareness home to everybody as far as what was possible and what could be done in response. I mean, I have to confess I'm not the most creative guy in the world, but I don't know if I would have thought of the idea of hacking the hackers back, which is essentially what he did to find out how this was being done.
Yeah, and the case to me is interesting because it indicates that at least the FBI and probably quite a bit of the rest of the intelligence community was new to this kind of thing, that they had to turn to using Sean to do their work for him. You would think they'd have, you know, here in the D.C. area, they'd have thousands of people doing that all the time. But just a 5 years ago, they didn't. So between then and now, where they certainly have much better, you know, cyber abilities like that, there's been a huge shift in how they operate.
Well, that's actually where I wanted to go next is, are we catching up fast enough, and are we headed in the right direction, do you think?
I think we are. I really do. I think there'll be a few more incidents that are extremely embarrassing to a whole bunch of people. But we've already had some disastrous attacks against the, especially the Defense Department. So we've had the Pentagon email servers completely owned by what they've said is were Chinese hackers. We've had the case of a worm spreading throughout military operations on the secret side of the network, spread by USB thumb drive. The cleanup for that, the Buckshot Yankee program, was to clean it up and re-image all the machines in the Defense Department. That's an expensive proposition. Yeah. So there have been a lot of wake-up calls. There will be more, but it's nothing that, you know, industry hasn't gone through over the last 5 years either.
That's what I want to talk about when we come back, because since I cover the government for a living, I'm focused on what's going on there. And so it's easy to lose track of the government versus private sector comparison. And these challenges that the government is facing are not really much different than what's going on in the private sector. And I think sometimes there is the assumption that they do it so much better. And let's talk about that a little bit when we come back from the break. Richard Steenan's my guest. He's author of the book Surviving Cyber War, among other credentials. You can find out more about him and the book at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. We'll be back in a moment.
The Pentagon and Beyond. brought to you by Eric.
There are consequences for posting those WikiLeaks documents. The Air Force has blocked access on its network to more than 24 media outlets who've posted them. The Pentagon has warned personnel not to go to the WikiLeaks site, but this takes it a step further, meaning U.S. Air Force personnel will not be able to get to those sites from their military networks. Among those blocked are The Guardian and The New York Times. I'm J.J. Green.
When you hear the word counterfeit, you automatically think of money. Well, it's much broader than that. Everything you buy has the potential of being counterfeit, especially those items that are hard to find and run the risk of becoming obsolete. And that's where Airing comes in. They're helping customers plan ahead for parts obsolescence so that when a part is needed, no matter how small, it's the real deal. When lives are at stake and relying on the integrity of systems is critical, there's no time to question authenticity. For more information and career opportunities, log on to arinc.com.
How can I keep my child healthy during flu season? My teenager's always online. How can I be sure he's not into something harmful? Parents Perspective has the answers. Sundays at 4 p.m. on WFED 1500 AM. Designate Parents Perspective 44415 with a generous donation in the combined federal campaign or online at www.parentsperspective.org. Thank you for helping Parents Perspective work for you.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife.
My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
Meeting mission goals through technology, brought to you by General Dynamics Information Technology.
The Department of Energy has given out the largest ever awards of the department's supercomputing time to 57 innovative research projects. Computer simulations will be used to perform virtual experiments that in most cases would be impossible or impractical. Using two world-leading supercomputers with a computational capacity roughly equal to 135,000 laptops. Officials say the research could, for example, help speed up the development of more efficient solar cells, make improvements in the production of biofuels, or develop medications that can help slow the progression of certain diseases. Selected projects were chosen for their potential to advance scientific discoveries, speed up technological innovations, and strengthen U.S. industrial competitiveness.
General Dynamics Information Technology, delivering the strength of technology to achieve mission success. General Dynamics IT. Visit GDIT.com to learn more.
Hey there, I'm Christopher Dorabeck. Here's what we're working on for the Dorabeck Insider this afternoon. Old Man Winter barely arrived. Snowmageddon still very much in our memory. What are OPM's plans for dealing with this winter? We'll find out. And Recovery.gov, a real leader in 2010. Transparency, cloud computing, open data. We're going to tap lessons learned with Earl Devaney of the Recovery and Transparency Board this afternoon, 3 to 7, on the Dorabeck Insider. It's right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Richard Steenan's my guest. He's author of the new book, Surviving Cyber War. And the formal rollout party is actually tomorrow, right?
So correct, yeah, at the National Press Club.
Got you a little bit early.
9 a.m.
Appreciate you doing that. When you sat down to write this book, most people who write a book have a thesis in mind and a point that they want to make. What was yours with this one?
Yeah, it was a historical perspective And I wanted to make sure, because there's been plenty of books that talked about information warfare, and all of them are somebody running around screaming, the sky is falling, mm-hmm. the end of the world is going to come. And I never subscribed to that idea at all, because I've seen the resiliency of our networks. And yeah, they go down, but they come back, mm-hmm. and you forget about what happened yesterday. So I wanted to make the point that, you know, it doesn't serve anybody to talk about this Cybergeddon that's approaching, because, you know, that's probably not going to happen. And it doesn't serve anybody to worry about that or think about how they're going to invest in avoiding that when these attacks are already happening. Mm-hmm. And some of the attacks that have occurred, I think, are devastating to industries, devastating certainly to the U.S. military, federal government. They've seen attacks already that are well worth a big response.
Yeah. It's interesting that you say that, because I had about 6 months or so, I had Dale Myros here, and I asked him that question. What do you think will happen? What would constitute to you this cyber Armageddon that people talk about? And he said, I don't really think that such a thing is possible. There aren't many people that are saying that. And I find that actually refreshing when I hear someone that's not the sky is falling type thing, because it's so easy when you hear some of the isolated stories to say this is really terrible stuff, and it can be a big downer. As you focus on some of the individual things that happen, and we've heard about a bunch of them in government, especially recently, WikiLeaks and so on, and we'll get into the nuts and bolts of some of those throughout the hour. But I think we get caught up in the idea that it's always worse in government, and that's not the case, is it? Some of the things the private sector is dealing with are just as bad or worse than what the government has to deal with.
Sure, because in the private sector, you know, money's being lost, and there's the threat against the infrastructure, so the power grid and water and gas and oil pipelines. But they've been aware of those for a long time, because there have been eco-terrorists that have taken pot shots at oil pipelines. So, you know, they run guards along them, and they have to protect their assets. So they've been doing an excellent job at that over the years. It's just that, as you brought out originally, it's the change, right? The types of threats are changing constantly, so it takes constant vigilance and constant reinvestment in technology.
Mm-hmm. Is the private sector, you said the federal government's doing a pretty good job of keeping up and trying to kind of get ahead of the curve. Private sector doing the same?
Yeah, private sector is way ahead of the federal government. Mm. So the issues facing the federal government and all the agencies, and all the way down to, you know, state and local government, are that they don't react fast enough. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just the budget cycles alone are longer than the evolutionary cycles for new cyber threats. Mm-hmm. We're engaged right now in discovering that even some of the largest companies in the world are vulnerable to pretty simplistic denial of service attacks. Even the federal government got hit by that in 2008 when during the attacks against a whole bunch of government agency websites, as well as South Korean websites. They reacted afterwards, and those sites are very, very robust right now. Mm-hmm. They're all hosted on a content delivery network, and very, very hard to take down with similar types of attacks. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of commercial entities that don't feel that they're targeted, right? Like MasterCard and Visa should have thought they would be targeted someday, but there's still, you know, Ford Motor, General Motors, you know, are they ever going to be targeted? You know, they think not until they are.
You mentioned the timeline compression here and how that relates to the federal budget cycle. If I'm a CIO or a CISO at an agency, the reality of the matter is the budget cycles have to be whatever they are, and they're going to stay whatever they are. But I got a network I got to protect every day, internally and externally, and we'll talk more about internal threats in the wake of WikiLeaks later on in the hour. But what's the reality that person should be thinking about to try to do their job and maybe try to separate what they're doing from the budget cycle instead of have them so tied together?
Yeah, the reality is that there's new technologies, and basically if they've invested in a particular platform for firewall or antivirus, they have to relook at that on a frequent schedule. I was standing at a trade show, and some short, burly guy comes up to me, and he's looking over my shoulder at the signage behind me, and he goes, "You security people are always introducing yet another box I got to buy from you to be secure." You know, it's almost as if it was the security industry's fault for creating all these things that needed to be defended against. And I got all huffy and started to lash back. And luckily, I didn't come up with what I thought later, but I blogged about it. And it's, "No, you, mister, turned out to be the CIO of one of the branches of the military. Do not... on your watch, you're being attacked and successfully, and, you know, you've got all this deployed, and yet people are breaking in and stealing your, you know, designs for your F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. You're doing something wrong." Mm-hmm. And the security industry is here, and they see, you know, they'll go to Israel or Turkey, where, you know, the hacking is the most virulent. And they'll see a problem, and they'll address the problem, and then they'll come back to the U.S. and they'll try and sell it to people, and they say, "Well, that's never happened here. We're not going to buy that today," until after the fact.
Yeah.
And we have to get out of this reactive mode. And at least, you know, I'm not saying invest in anything to protect you against something that's never happened. But just look around. Mm-hmm. A lot of this stuff has happened. And, you know, your email servers have been taken down at the Pentagon. So maybe, you know, somebody over at Health and Human Services should worry about their mm-hmm. email servers.
Is there a lot of predictive nature to what you see in cyber intrusions?
The predictive part is there are a lot of people think about what could happen, and there's a whole bunch of, you know, hackers per se who are on the good side, right? So they think about what could happen and they look for vulnerabilities. But there are very few people who could predict the type of carefully crafted tool that was used, now attributed fairly strongly to taking down Iranian uranium refining centrifuges.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that, even though, you know, people talked about industrial backdoors and sabotage, very difficult to predict because it's so clever and it's so targeted
mm-hmm.
and evidently was successful.
Yeah. Richard Steenan is the author of Surviving Cyber War. He's my guest on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. It's In Depth with Francis Rose. And we'll talk about some of the human elements of cybersecurity when we come back on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Scanlon. The U.S. Senate says yes to the tax cut deal put together by President Obama and congressional Republicans, and it was a huge vote, 81 to 19. NBC's Kelly O'Donnell tells us the House will likely approve the tax and jobless benefits agreement, but by nowhere near the margin in the Senate. President Obama calls the measure a win for middle-class families and a win for the economy. There is no comedy on another issue, the START treaty with the Russians. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs says Republicans are putting political stunts ahead of our national security by threatening to delay passage of the treaty. Republican John Kyle wants the Senate clerk to read the entire treaty to the Senate. And in Wichita, Kansas, two elderly motorists drove into their doctor's office literally. A woman accidentally hit the gas pedal and drove through the glass front of the clinic. The glass was replaced, and 5 hours later, a man hit the accelerator by mistake, too. Good day for the window installer. More news at MSNBC.com. I'm Dan Scanlon, NBC News Radio.
There's so many people that make your life full. Rachel, my yoga teacher. She finally got me into a headstand.
My best friend, Anne, who I never see enough of.
Tina, our babysitter. The kids ask us to go out because she's so much fun.
This Christmas, let them know what they mean to you with a Hallmark card. Because a card says, I appreciate you in a way that nothing else can.
Sarah, my work BFF. She always makes me laugh.
Pick out a card for everyone on your list today. Wherever Hallmark cards are sold. Hallmark cards. Make it meaningful.
Your child has a fever, and of course you worry. You're a mom. That's your job. But there's no need to worry about which medicine to choose. Fact. Children's Advil brings your child's fever down faster than Children's Tylenol. And Children's Advil keeps that fever down longer. Nothing's proven better on fever. Not even Children's Motrin. For relief you can trust, look for Children's Advil in the cough cold aisle now.
Among OTC pain relievers, brands are trademarks of their respective owners. Based on reducing fever below 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
In today's shrinking economy, one industry is growing rapidly, cybersecurity. As cyber threats continue to increase, so do new job opportunities in both the public and private sectors. The Center for Cybersecurity Training at UMBC Training Centers is preparing the new cyber workforce to fill the jobs and meet the growing need. Here, individuals and organizations receive the knowledge, skills, and certifications required to protect our nation's vital networks, systems, public infrastructure, and information. UMBC Training Centers offers flexible class schedules and locations in Maryland and Virginia. And as one of America's recognized leaders in professional, scientific, and technical education and training, we offer advanced programs that are second to none. Cybersecurity jobs are here, and more are coming. Get trained for them now at the Center for Cybersecurity Training at UMBC Training Centers. Visit cyber.umbctrainingcenters.com. Go to cyber.umbctrainingcenters.com and register for a free webinar today.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series, Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Dell, and AVIEW Technologies. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m., right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
I'm not just some tall drink of water, you know. I mean, I wash your dishes, I do the laundry, I help put out fires. I'm always there when you need me, 24/7, at home, at work, just about anywhere. And I'm not expensive, but I have great taste. Well, I guess I am a tall drink of water, but I'm tap water, and that makes me special. For more information about what only tap water delivers, visit drinktap.org.
40 kilometers northwest of Kandahar, Afghanistan, at a remote desert military base, American soldiers are playing video games. There are cold drinks, snacks, comfy chairs, and an internet connection. It's the USO To Go program, and it's just one of the ways the USO supports our troops, lifts their spirits, and serves as a link with the American people. Find out how you can help. Visit us at USO.org. The USO, until everyone comes home.
Profile America, Wednesday, December 15th. One of the most notable films in U.S. movie history opened on this date in 1939 in Atlanta, Georgia, Gone with the Wind, based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the Civil War by Margaret Mitchell. The movie, starring Clark Gable and Vivian Leigh, was a huge success, winning a then-unprecedented 8 Academy Awards. The publicity surrounding the premiere was such that 300,000 people braved the cold to watch the stars arrive at Lowe's Grand Theater, and the governor of Georgia proclaimed a state holiday in honor of the event. In 1939, there were more than 15,000 movie theaters across the U.S. Today, that figure is just under 5,000. You can find these and more facts about America from the U.S. Census Bureau online at census.gov.
Good news for the uninsured and the insured. U.S. Healthy People 2020 Network is now offering annual health physical to the public. Members receive comprehensive health assessments for hypertension, thyroid, kidney, osteoporosis, diabetes, cholesterol, heart screening, and more till the year 2020. Find out your risks for heart attack or stroke. Take the extra step you and your family need to stay healthy till 2020 and beyond. Call 301-386-2223 or visit ushealthypeople2020.org for details. Sponsored by Prevent First, a nonprofit health organization.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest is Richard Steenan. He's the author of Surviving Cyber War. Book releases, big book launch tomorrow at the National Press Club, and I'm fortunate to have him in studio with me for the hour today. We were talking before the break about the human element of some of the cybersecurity challenges that the government's dealing with, and the most notable one, at least until WikiLeaks came along a couple of weeks ago, was the Buckshot Yankee issue that the Pentagon was dealing with. In 2008, Secretary Lynn announced about 3 months ago, somebody in a DOD person stuck a thumb drive in the network in the Middle East somewhere.
Right.
And the thumb drive was infected with, correct me if I'm wrong, it was malware?
Yeah, it was a worm.
Okay. Yep. And the network was compromised and it caused all kinds of problems, obviously. The problem was not necessarily the thumb drive. The problem was not necessarily the DOD network. The problem, it seems to me, was the person who either didn't have sufficient instruction as to what's appropriate and what's not for network hygiene, or just didn't think. And that becomes the issue, I think, for a lot of CIOs and CISOs in government to deal with is, I can be compliant, I can be confident that my network is clean, that I'm doing everything in my control, but I can't sit next to every single employee at my agency and make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to do.
Yeah. And I'm a big proponent of using technology wherever possible to account for that, right? It's, you can't train people to use better passwords or to change your password every 2 weeks, but it's pretty simple to make them change your password every 2 weeks. You don't let them log in. And the issue with thumb drives is, you know, it's just been years since, if networks were segmented away from each other as SIPRNet and NIPRNet are, you know, the security from, you know, the secure side from the classified side, then, you know, what more natural way to transfer data back and forth between them is by thumb drives. Mm-hmm. They're ubiquitous. We've got hundreds or thousands of them. You get them in the mail from vendors and other suspicious sources. You pick one up in the parking lot, which is Ian White did a famous,
that's a great
famous
idea.
Test. Yeah. They infiltrated companies by just leaving them around because people, you stick them in, see what's on there. You might find something, whatever. So they're so prevalent and used all the time that people do tend to plug them in. Now, in, you know, there's a case of a thumb drive being used to steal data from Mitsui Bank in London once. And from there it led to, you know, a $120 million bank theft. And their reaction to that was to super glue all closed. And that's actually, you know, according to Lynn, they're doing similar things inside some of the departments. But there's software that you can use to control what gets plugged in there. We'll check it before it gets plugged in.
Mm-hmm.
Might not necessarily have, you know, stopped or discovered the Stuxnet worm, which also was installed in some facility in Iran that way initially before it spread.
Yeah.
And it, you know, there'll probably be eventually a government approved way of using USB thumb drives that can be enforced. But there's going to be something else.
That, right.
You know, the humans are, you know, you can't ask everybody in government not to use new technology. So there'll be a game console. There'll be the latest iPhone or Droid that you happen to carry with you that just happens to connect automatically to Wi-Fi networks. And you're inside the building and boom, you just connected the inside of the building to the outside.
That was where I wanted to go next, was to talk about the fact that it soon, in fact, in some cases now, the thumb drive or the CD or whatever's not even the issue. The mobile devices that people carry around that they buy on their own at the store are so powerful and so connected that that becomes the next river potentially of information out of agencies. If I'm a forward-thinking CIO, CISO, what do I need to be thinking about mobile devices and mobile computing to either keep my network segregated from these devices that are becoming ubiquitous, or if I'm maybe a little bit more free-thinking, trying to segregate the information that's on the network so the mobile devices can't access the stuff I don't want accessed?
Yeah, I think the best way is to think about the security of whatever those devices are going to be and make sure that you allow them. So there's got, you know, iPads. Wouldn't it be great if, you know, your workforce were using iPads effectively for something? They'd always have their presentations with them. They'd always be connected. But then secure it as well. And, you know, research what available tools there are to make it secure. And then do, you know, we're getting to the point quickly where so-called digital rights management, where documents, files, media are all encrypted all the time, and only specific people can open them and have access to them. And when they do open them and have access to them, there's a record of it somewhere. And that's where we're going to lock down control of data walking out of the organization.
Yeah, the people that I'm talking to that I trust the most when it comes to these kinds of things say that's where we're headed. Is it's fruitless to try to lock down all of these devices,
right.
and it's the information that needs to be secured. And the DRM is one that I'm familiar with when it comes to music,
right.
And that's just, I mean, it's to the point now where it's starting to go away in the MP3 music world. But that's what you expect to see happening more and more with data.
Yeah, and I think the driver is going to be the WikiLeaks. Because if you ask the question, how in the world could you stop somebody from stealing cables inside the State Department when hundreds of thousands of people have access to them, you can't. So there would have to be controls over it so that what you do is you make it impossible to steal it without somebody knowing that you were the one who stole it. And then you won't have people surreptitiously walking off with the data.
I guess the good news about WikiLeaks, and we'll talk more in depth about that in just a moment, but the good news is somebody figured it out. I mean, they know exactly, or they say they know exactly who it is that's released all of these pieces of information, and the person that they've accused of doing it hasn't denied doing it. Mm-hmm. So I guess if there's any good news about it, it's at least they know what the original source was.
Yeah, if you are the owner, or if you've gained access to, you know, hundreds of thousands of communications, it's pretty easy to connect the dots and figure out who was the one person who had access to all of those.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a big arrow pointed on your head.
Yeah. Richard Steenen's my guest. He's author of the book Surviving Cyber War. More information about him and about his blog and about the book Surviving Cyber War at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And we'll talk in at a little bit of length about WikiLeaks when we continue on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Video teleconferencing solutions are changing the way people communicate by breaking down walls and enabling face-to-face communication, regardless of distance or environment. Tanberg, now a part of Cisco, developed Break Down the Walls to provide a window into the ways government, education, and healthcare organizations are using VTC solutions to help them operate more effectively and efficiently, and the ways video solutions can be used to address challenges facing public sector organizations today. Learn more at BreakDownTheWalls.com.
Hi, I'm Denise Ballou of the FBI. The case was revealed in December 1995. Operation Senior Sentinel targeted illegal boiler rooms and telemarketing fraud.
The case was hugely significant in that it's one of the few, if not only, instances I can think of where an entire crime problem was basically wiped out by very focused, dramatic investigation.
Keith Slaughter is special agent in charge of FBI San Diego. Formerly in Miami, he initiated the undercover operation that evolved into Senior Sentinel.
These were telemarketers who were really, really bad individuals who were promising big prizes and a lot of different things, preying on customers, especially the elderly.
Many were conned into losing their life savings, but the tables were turned.
Instead of using undercover agents in those cases, we used a combination of retired agents and retired citizens affiliated with the AARP to pose as victims.
Ultimately, about 1,200 arrests and hundreds of convictions. I'm Denise Ballou of the Bureau on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Newsmakers on the Dorabeck Insider.
Prashant Garg, the president of the American Council for Technology, the Obama administration's proposal to improve the management of government information technology.
We have the OMB and OFFP working together on this, and we will be communicating with them. I have not seen as much communication as I'm seeing right now in terms of literally emails saying, what do you think of this, and should we go this way? And that's great.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/Dorabeck Insider. Federal news and information just got more fun and interesting. Amy Morris joins Tom Temin on The Federal Drive, weekday mornings from 6 to 10. Tom and Amy tailor their show for Feds on the Go with usable information from trustworthy and seasoned journalists. You're going to learn, but they also might make you laugh. The Federal Drive with Tom Temin and Amy Morris, 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest is Richard Steenen. He's author of the book Surviving Cyber War, which comes out tomorrow, and you can find out more about it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Later this afternoon, also the host of the Threat Chaos blog at threatchaos.com, and we'll have that linked up too. Everybody's been talking about WikiLeaks. We've talked about it on this station a lot, obviously in media across the world. And the issues of what should happen to Bradley Manning and what should happen to Julian Assange and all of these others are separated from, I think, the potential to learn lessons from inside, especially from my viewpoint, inside government agencies. We've talked a lot about cybersecurity, and the internal threat part of the conversation usually seems to be tacked on at the end if there's 2 or 3 minutes left after we've talked about external threats from nation states and organized crime and on and on and on. And I'm certainly not trying to downplay the severity of those threats. Why do you think it's taken us so long to think about and now focus on internal threats as we saw through this WikiLeaks scandal?
I think it's a matter of trust. So we've got these boundaries of trust, and people who work for us, we trust, because if they do something egregious, we're going to fire them. So there's a pretty big penalty. And we trust the people that we hire because we put them through background checks. But the one thing that we leave out is those people, you know, they've got different motivations, and those motivations change over time. And you never know what's going to spark them to think that they can steal some data, just seeing the data, and they just don't build up that, they don't return the trust.
Mm-hmm. The argument during the recent hubbub about the TSA and who they screen and who they don't, one of the arguments there was Al-Qaeda would, or whoever hates us and wants to blow up airplanes, would like to recruit people that don't necessarily look like what people consider to be the stereotypical appearance of somebody who is a bomber. The same thing, I imagine, could be said about cybersecurity, in that somebody who has a history of being just a normal individual, an upstanding citizen, a patriot, whatever, who would pass a background check with flying colors, theoretically would be the perfect kind of person for the Julian Assanges of the world, or the anybody who wants to become a cyber criminal, person for them to recruit.
While that's true in insider abuse cases, the studies that have been done, you know, show about 80% of the time they're very easy to profile. They're male, 25 to 35 years old, married, two kids, and they have Star Trek paraphernalia on their desk.
So I should probably put away all of them. Yeah, well, I'm too old for that profile, though, so I got that going for me, which is nice. So that being said, though, since we do have kind of this profile in place, is it appropriate for agencies to be doing the kinds of things that theoretically they're doing, but I don't know if they're doing in practice, as far as follow-up background checks like they do in the intelligence community and on an ongoing basis?
I'm not sure if they could afford to do that, but you don't have to. You can monitor network behavior and see when things change, mm-hmm. and be warned early of the types of things, you know, accessing the server late at night or something. But before that, warn everybody, you know, publish in your policies that we are monitoring everything you do. Mm-hmm. If you do anything out of the ordinary, we're going to be looking over your shoulder, and that'll just stop it from happening. Mm-hmm. Cause you know, you want to catch somebody, you know, if you've got thousands of people in your department, you want to catch somebody before they decide and make that critical decision. Ooh, I'm going to grab this and leak it. Now to, you know, WikiLeaks is the one place that people are totally aware of. And Julian Assange says he's just, you know, they've got terabytes of data coming at them from all sources, thanks to all their publicity. But there'll be splinter groups from WikiLeaks, and mm-hmm. there'll be hundreds, if not thousands, of places that are republishing information that's stolen.
I read the one guy who was working with Assange has left, and he's going to start his own.
Yep.
And the first thing I thought of was, is it possible at some point that there could be so many that they collapse of their own lack of weight because there's not one focus of critical mass anymore?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think there's not their business model is kind of out there, right?
Yeah.
So one, WikiLeaks, it gets all the attention, can get donations, but can 1,000 of them?
Yeah.
Other than the time donated by the guys who own the servers.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing I thought was interesting was the progression of that then is, if it becomes almost a capitalistic model, which kind of seems to be antithetical to what the people who believe in it are all about. But at some point, if it's WikiLeaks that has the brand recognition and they become the 800-pound gorilla in that room, whatever you want to call that room, I wonder if then it becomes such a monolith that the kind of person that's attracted to it isn't really attracted to it anymore. Maybe I think about these things too much. I don't know.
You certainly think about them a lot.
Well, maybe I should refocus on my Star Trek stuff or something like that. My guest is Richard Steenan. He is the author of the book Surviving Cyber War, my guest for the hour on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. We'll be back in a moment to wrap up.
I'm not just some tall drink of water, you know. I mean, I wash your dishes, I do the laundry, I help put out fires. I'm always there when you need me, 24/7, at home, at work, just about anywhere. And I'm not expensive. But I have great taste. Well, I guess I am a tall drink of water, but I'm tap water, and that makes me special. For more information about what only tap water delivers, visit drinktap.org.
I'm Beyonce with an important message about hunger in America. Did you know 1 in 8 people struggle with hunger? Over 12 million children live in homes where there isn't always enough food. Food banks are experiencing more demand than ever. Show Your Helping Hand is a nationwide campaign with the goal of helping Feeding America deliver millions of meals to local food banks. Please join me in showing a helping hand to fight hunger. More information is available at showyourhelpinghand.com.
If you've been around Washington as long as I have, you know the one constant is change. The players change, laws change. If you're a federal retiree or soon to be one, you need to know that some of those changes could affect your retirement future. There's one association fighting to make sure that doesn't happen, and that's NARF, the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association. If you work for or have worked for Uncle Sam, you need NARF. NARF is the only association that's dedicated to when you reach retirement. Don't wait until after you retire to join NARF. Check out their website at www.narfe.org. You'll see that NARF is a great investment for your retirement future. Then click on the Join Now button and join hundreds of thousands of federal retirees and employees as a NARF member. Or call them at 800-627-3394, 800-627-3394, and have them send you more information.
Tune in to Fed Central, dedicated to sharing insights and best practices on topics ranging from cybersecurity to sustainability to healthcare reform. Hear straight talk from government leaders and industry specialists on the issues that are shaping how agencies serve their mission and their constituents. Hosted by veteran broadcaster Jane Norris, don't miss Fed Central on the third and fourth Wednesday of the month at 1 p.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m. Sponsored by Deloitte.
Congratulations on landing the job. I'm really excited for you.
Thanks. How's your search going?
The job market's tight. I mean, I can barely get an interview, yeah. And I've got student loans to deal with. You're lucky, you know. The National Guard paid your loans off.
Luck? The Guard was a smart decision, one you can still make.
The National Guard Student Loan Repayment Program can pay up to $50,000 of your existing student loans. Get the details at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the D.C. National Guard, aired by the Maryland, D.C. Delaware Broadcasters Association and this station.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And my thanks to Richard Steenan, who is author of Surviving Cyber War, and my guest for the hour today. Tell me again about tomorrow at the National Press Club. Starts what time?
Yeah, at 9 AM at the National Press Club. And, you know, press and policymakers, anybody in IT security or having anything to do with cyber or cyber defense is welcome. And you just show up.
The introduction of the book Surviving Cyber War, and I poured through a couple of chapters of this book over the weekend, and I want to go back to what we talked about at the beginning to bring it around to a close. Just the title of the book gives away the thesis of the book to a degree. Okay. The idea that we focus so much on the fact that these challenges are so difficult and they're so hard and potentially cataclysmic, but there will be the next day after whatever the next bad cybersecurity situation is.
Yeah, exactly. And the book also ties it back to just an IT administrator inside a company or a small department. So you might not be engaged in battling Chinese espionage every day or be on the forefront in Tallinn, Estonia as Russia tries to take your entire country off the network. But you could become collateral damage. And the tools and techniques used against Iran for Stuxnet are now being translated into more broadly distributed malware and kits, toolkits for doing these attacks. So mm-hmm. there'll be fallout from cyber war that impacts you no matter what walk of life you're in.
Fortunately, this is not structured like a novel, so we can go to the very end of the book without giving away the entire book. And as I've said earlier in the show, I like to focus on the fact that not everything that's happening in the cyber world is terrible. The last segment of your book is titled, What Good Could Arise from Cyber War? Here are some positive developments. Talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah, it's the if we have early types of attacks, as I think we had, then we can be reactionary and get up speed before the more dangerous ones occur. So, you know, we know that a couple times the power grid in the United States has failed, sometimes attributed to malware or not. So that gives the operators of electrical distribution organizations to it gives them an opportunity to fix those things that led to that vulnerability before there's a disaster in the middle of winter that leaves us without power for a while.
Mm-hmm.
The exact same thing with attacks against the Pentagon in 2007, you know, major revamping of Pentagon security internally that presumably is going to prevent that from happening again. With Buckshot E, you know, major changes in how the Defense Department is handling data across CIPRNet. And we'll continue to have those, and hopefully they're small little ones. The same argument that a geologist would make in California, you know, having little earthquakes is good.
Mm-hmm.
It pushes off the time we'll have the big one.
Yeah. If we talk about this again in 2 years or 5 years, where do you see trends headed? Where do you see potential for gains as we try to get in front of this issue and maybe take a more, when I say offensive, I don't mean that we're out hacking other people necessarily, but instead of always playing defense where we're trying to get a little bit proactive, I guess, is the term that I'm looking for. What do you see happening in any of those areas?
The biggest change which has got to happen is responsibility has got to be assigned for the cyber defense side. And today it's a little easy for, you know, every time you see a announcement from within government that a major attack occurred, it's always followed up by, but don't worry, nothing was actually stolen of importance.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe that would be the case for, you know, the Pentagon's email servers.
Right.
And over the next 2 years, the assignment of responsibility will be pushed down to every level in the organization. There'll probably be a new organization created by Congress that requires the president to have somebody in the cybersecurity position that actually has budgetary control. So it's not all good news for the way people buy things and deploy things. But we'll get to the point where that's under control, and we can only worry about the next big thing, which is attacks against network backbone routers, which mm-hmm. we haven't addressed yet.
And there is always a lot more to cover than there is time to cover it, and I'm grateful for your time today. It's great to have you on the show. Richard Steenen is author of Surviving Cyber War. The book roll out tomorrow at the National Press Club at 9 o'clock. You can learn more about the book and Richard and a lot more at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. You can also hear my conversation with Richard in its entirety there, and thank you again for being on the show today. Great to have you.
Thank you, Francis. It was great.
Happy to have you. The Dorbeck Insider is up next between 3 and 7 this afternoon on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. A brand new In-Depth with Francis Rose tomorrow at 1 and Industry Chatter at 1. And then at 2 o'clock tomorrow, Linda Springer, former director of the Office of Personnel Management, will be my guest on In-Depth on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.